Reds players are in the news every day during baseball season. You don't have to go far to hear about the great defensive plays or the walk-off heroics. But the one thing you don't hear very much about are the players' wives and what their lives are like during the baseball season. Good evening, I'm Howard Wilkinson. Tonight we'll take you to a time before free agency when ballplayers didn't have million-dollar contracts and had to find work in the offseason to make ends meet. You'll hear Eleanor Kluczewski recall activities the wives did together. Joyce Bell Dahl remembers the car trips with the kids to spring training. Joe McMillan talks about the Reds ladies bowling team. Priscilla Stowe tells us the story of how she met longtime Reds equipment manager Bernie Stowe. And Betty Hoyt shares memories of legendary Reds broadcaster Wade Hoyt. So let's begin. Cincinnati Reds, Baseball Wives.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remove your caps and stand for the singing of our national anthem.
Eleanor Kluczewski is the wife of the late Ted Kluczewski, the Reds' great slugger of the 1950s, whose statue sits out on Crosley Terrace, one of the four players that has had that honor, and one of the great players of all time. And Joyce Bell Dahl is the widow of Gus Bell, an outfielder for the Reds in the 1950s and early 1960s. He was one of four players in Reds history who had three home runs in a game more than once. You are not only the wife of a major league player, but the mother of a major league player in Buddy Bell.
And the grandmother of a major league player, yeah.
That's right. Grandmother of Michael and David. Three generations of Bells who played in the major leagues. I just want to talk to you a little bit about what it was like in the 1950s, 1960s, when your husbands were playing baseball, being a baseball wife. Could you tell me a little bit about how you and Ted met?
We were in high school. We went through 4 years of high school. He actually grade school also, sixth, seventh, and eighth in grade school. I had him pegged for a long time. But we didn't start dating until we were juniors in high school. So that's how we got together.
When were you married?
1946. And February.
At that point, was he still in college at that point?
Yes, Indiana.
And he was a football star.
Football. And he tried basketball and, well, baseball. He dropped basketball because he couldn't do three sports. They wouldn't let him come home for Christmas, so he dropped basketball. But football and baseball.
So by the time Ted reached major leagues, you'd been married for a while.
No, actually, we were married in 46 and signed the contract and went down. Our first stop was Columbia, South Carolina. He only spent 2 years in the minors. Columbia in Memphis, Tennessee, and then he was up in 48 and stayed.
Joyce, tell me a little bit about how you and Gus met.
Well, we actually met at a party. He was there with my cousin and his best friend. I was supposed to kind of try to hook up with him. His name was Ted. And before we left that night, Gus had my phone number. He called me the next day, and that was it.
And when did you get married?
We got married in December 1949.
Gus's major league career began when?
In 1950. Memorial Day of 1950, was called up to Pittsburgh.
You'd been married then about a year or so by the time?
No, just probably what, from December to the following May when he was called up, 4 or 5 months.
Tell me a little bit, Eleanor, about your memories of Crosley Field and what kind of place that was for the wives of the players.
Oh, well, certainly not like what they have today. We had to wait outside. There was no clubhouse. So if it was raining or whatever it was doing, I can remember taking my shoes off because the tunnel would be flooded. I wouldn't go ruin my shoes, so I took my shoes off, and we just all stood out there. And Ted usually was the last one out of the clubhouse. I swear they were signing him to clean the clubhouse. It's quite different. I mean, literally, that's what we had to do. There was no place for us to go unless we went to our cars and when they came out. But there was no place because the ball club had already shut the lights off. And
did you go to a lot of the games?
I went to every game, yeah. Doubleheaders included. We did, didn't we? We just pretty much just go. I did for the doubleheaders, yeah.
Did the wives all sit together in those days?
Pretty much, yeah. We used to all sit together.
Yeah,
it was. Gus told me one time, every time he looked, I was talking and eating, but I always knew what the score was.
Well,
it's something you kind of get used to.
And I kept score. I still have the score, the books from when I kept score all the time.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
I keep score, too, for every game I go to. Did you have much interaction with the fans?
No, you learn early on that you don't do that. That's not a good idea. Columbia, South Carolina, I was doing that, and I got called, that I told them I was a bag of worms. They called me a bag of worms. True.
But obviously, I mean, your husbands would have interaction with the fans, signing autographs.
Oh, yeah,
kind of
definitely,
thing,
yeah.
Well, it's kind of a difficult thing when you sit there also
and keep
at the game,
shut.
And you have to be quiet when you hear fans criticizing. That never happened to me, but our really good friend Sue, Herm Wehmeyer's wife, that was a pitcher, and he was Cincinnati boy.
Hometown.
Hometown. They just crucified him, and she would have to sit there and listen to that. It was really difficult. You didn't want to turn around and say something, but you just didn't.
Yeah, that had to be hard.
It was very difficult.
To listen to
hecklers
and booing and that kind of thing.
Especially with somebody like Herm, because he was a wonderful person.
And the minute they find out who you are, then that it just piles on, so you're better off just not saying anything.
Did the wives do things together outside of the ballpark?
Yeah. We would do outings. We went to Coney.
To the movies, dinner, when they were on the road,
right.
Things like that. Of course, baby showers. We used to go as couples out to eat after a game together.
After a game. And when we got together, and they'll probably laugh when I say we played charades.
Right, we did, yeah.
Now if your thumbs aren't going and pushing buttons. But we had a lot of fun. The wives always beat the guys because, of course, we were going to the movies while they were playing. So we made sure that we always played movies, had movie themes. So we pretty much reamed their clocks when we were playing charades. During the All-Star game, we would have picnics. We went to, I don't know what the wives do nowadays. I have no idea.
I don't think they do as much together now as they used to. Just still being kind of close to people that are involved in it. Things that I know that they do and don't do, they're just kind of, first of all, they probably have a couple of homes where they play, you know,
airplanes.
And then they can go back home. I'm sure they still have the closeness, but they still don't do the things like we used to do.
How difficult was it with your husband gone a lot of the year, either on the road or at spring training or whatever, and raising a family?
We used to take the children all to spring training, and then we would have school. We never put them in school. We would always have permission from school, and they would give us their books and things like that. When we were in Tampa, we'd get up early in the morning, have school, and then kind of go over to Clearwater every day, over to the beach.
The beach, yeah.
The car looked like it was a beach by the time we got home because with all the sand, trying to keep that out of there and everything. But we always tried to go.
It's completely different. These guys probably room by themselves now. And, of course, when our guys were playing, they had roommates. They traveled by train. They did 3-week road trips. Ted hated the trains because he didn't fit in the bunks. A whole new way they play now. And that's probably for the better. And now they very rarely play a doubleheader unless it's a makeup game. And if a guy plays a night game, then maybe the catcher doesn't catch that next day. Our guys played 24/7 type of baseball.
Did you look forward to spring training?
Oh, yes. Although everybody always thought, well, you're going on your vacation. Well, let's see. Laundry had to get done. Food had to be picked up at the stores. You had to cook your meals. So, yeah, it was fun. But we were also just transporting what we did in Cincinnati and what we did in spring training. A little more relaxed, but it still hadn't. The everyday stuff had to get done the same way.
Did the wives or children ever go on road trips during the regular season?
At later years, you were allowed to go maybe on one road trip. My kids, they never took them on a road trip. However, I know they do now, though.
I used to drive into Chicago all the time because we're from outside of Chicago. So, like, parking would be $3 across from the Wrigley Field. Ted always went over, and the gentleman that owned the service station would save me a parking place. It cost me more to park my car in the hotel garage than it did to park at Wrigley Field. Yeah, I drove pretty much always into Chicago when they played.
Obviously, your husband didn't make the big mega dollars that players make today. You know, they're averaging $3 million a year and that sort of thing. And a lot of the players had to do jobs in the off season. Was that the case with Gus?
Gus worked for the Reds. He would call on businesses that had the box seats for them to renew their box seats. And for the upcoming, we're kind of as a public relations type job. He made $75 a week.
Ted and Herm worked for Burger Beer, I think. Before we were married, when to show you really going back the dark ages, when Ted was working in a factory, his salary was 45 cents an hour.
Yeah, times have changed.
Slightly.
Yeah. A little bit.
But yeah. That was something that you really had to do. I mean,
but nobody really thought anything about it. I mean,
no.
That's just what you did. Everybody worked two jobs. I don't think there was anybody other than the ones that might have played winter ball down the Dominican or somewhere like that. For the most part, they all had winter jobs. I think it was just what people did.
Ted, after a while, he did TV for WLW for a while, but that wasn't his cup of tea. It really wasn't. He was not a natural at it at all. You have to have, I think he kind of froze up when that little red light went on.
Now, of course, Ted had the restaurant then, too.
And he would go down and do PR work. He loved to go down on Saturdays because he would help cut the steaks. He liked to do that. And then bring a few home, too.
Both of your husbands, at some point in their career, were traded. Is that difficult? How difficult is that for the families and for the players themselves?
I think it's traumatic. I mean, Ted was with the Reds for 10 years, so that was traumatic for us. Fortunately, it was just to Pittsburgh, so we just commuted. We weren't about to sell the house. We just rented a house in Pittsburgh. But when you've been someplace for 10 years...
And Gus was with the Reds for...
Nine seasons. It wasn't that traumatic.
I forgot where he went. Where did he go?
He was the first one drafted to go with the Mets.
The Mets.
Because that last year that he played here was not really maybe the happiest time. Not unhappy, but kind of the way things went. Obviously, up in New York, we weren't going to take the children. We went up there to look for a place to live, so we were going to have to commute. And then, fortunately, he got traded to Milwaukee. So he really wasn't with the Mets just 3 months or so. I think he was traded in May up to Milwaukee.
Were there particular teammates that your husbands were close to?
I've known Mrs. McMillan, 1952 when she came up, I think, for some reason, with Gus and Herm and Roy.
Well, in Gus' room with Joe Nuxall Wally
Nux,
Post.
Yeah.
And all three of them. I remember one time they came home from the road, got the suitcase open to wash the clothes. There was a shirt that didn't belong there and socks that didn't belong in there. The shirt, I forget who it was belonged to, either Joe or Wally. Could they just kind of pass things around, their clothes and stuff like that? They just pick them up in the room because they roomed together.
Wasn't one of Ted's problems. As big as he was, he roomed with Johnny Temple.
He was a little different in size.
Yeah, exactly. So
I think they all had kind of a closeness because we did do things together.
Oh, yeah. We went to Mecklenburg's all the time. Mecklenburg's pretty much after the game, and on Sunday we would be at Olsner's Tavern across the river. because you could get drinks on Sunday where you couldn't here. And they gave them to us in cups, so everybody thought we were having coffee. Now I'm going to get put in jail, right?
What about the managers that they played for, case of Bertie Tebbets?
There were doozies.
Yeah.
I can remember Ted slid into home plate, and he was bleeding, and Hornsby said, do you think you can keep on playing? And as long as he was manager, I don't know about you, but he never spoke to the wives. At least never said hello to me.
Well, Rogers Hornsby had a reputation as not being a real pleasant fellow.
Well, that he wasn't.
Not a whole lot of personality.
No.
He was just different.
Yeah, very different. Yeah. Well, he was egotistical, and when you think you're that much better than, I suppose he had good records, obviously, but that's not any way to manage, I don't think.
I think Bertie was one of Gus's favorite managers ever that he played for.
People like Ted and Gus, if they had a good day, did they bring it home with them and talk about it?
Gus never did. Never brought it home, ever.
It just wasn't part of the discussion.
Back then, what was said in the clubhouse stayed in the clubhouse. It's not like it's immediately on the YouTube.
In our case, too, with the kids at home, that was a whole different kind of thing going on because the kids were just happy when he came home. It was never an issue.
The only thing I didn't like was if Ted had a good streak going, he wouldn't let me wash his clothes. It sometimes was not nice. But we would talk baseball because I've played baseball. I could a lot of times pick up things that he was doing wrong. And then we had home movies, too, because they had gotten a camera. I think that's actually how it started, when picked up on taking pictures of the games.
You'd watch his plate appearances, and you could pick them apart and talk
about
it.
Pretty much, yes. Mm-hmm.
Obviously, like you said, it was his job.
Hopefully we did a good job with our kids, because we always told them that that's your dad's job, because you would go sometime, and there were some children that they kind of brag a lot about their fathers, and that was fine. We really didn't want that. It was just, this is my dad, that's what he does, and it doesn't make him special because he plays baseball. Because I think that was passed on to Buddy. Buddy's done a great job with his kids
definitely.
With that. And it was mainly Gus. He just didn't want any of that. He went to work. He got paid just like anybody else. It was just different because somebody was watching them, so it really didn't make any difference.
I always wondered kind of if you were the son of a Major League Baseball player and you wanted to play baseball yourself, how your father would influence you. Did Gus encourage Buddy?
He encouraged him because that's what he wanted to do. Some of our children wanted to do other things. Regardless of what they did, he encouraged them to try. But that's all Buddy ever did. I've got movies of him at home when he was a year and a half, 2 years old, with a Reds baseball cap with a great big pin in the back of it, holding it on his head, and a little bat this long batting it out in the backyard and running around like he was running the bases. So there was no holding him back. No more than the other kids were to kind of do what they liked to do.
And I'm sure that's the case with Buddy's kids, too.
Well, all three of his boys all loved it. All of baseball. Not all of my kids. They liked it, but they liked to do other things.
What were the proudest achievements of your husband's careers in their minds?
He got to play in a World Series. If you pin every ball player down, that's probably a goal that they would try to attain. And at least he got to do it 1 year and had a good World Series also.
Unfortunately, it wasn't here, but it was
White Sox.
With the White
1959,
Sox.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. More than the home run records and the
well, that
RBI
came in second. Leagues. That was certainly an accomplishment also, obviously. But it would have been nice if it could have been with the Reds because he did have 10 years here, but you take it when you can get it.
How about Gus?
I guess I would have to say the World Series, but I have to honestly say he never really ever talked about it.
Oh, I don't. Ted didn't either. This is just knowing Ted. We played in the All-Star games. When you got voted into the All-Star game, you know, that was always nice. After he was out of baseball and before he died, I do remember that was always his answer, the World Series of 1959.
Well, I think that it's a goal of everybody to get in the World Series. When you start playing, you want to be on a winning team and get to the World Series.
In the 50s, I think the Reds, I forgot what the year was, that they tied a major league record for home team home runs. But that's never mentioned either. That's
1956, never talked to. I believe.
I was going to say 56. I wasn't sure, yeah.
Was that 222 or something like that?
222 or 21, something like that. And they don't talk about that. Gus hit 40 home runs. And Post, Bailey, Ted. I don't know whether Greengrass hit 40 or not, but he was close in the high 30s. So you had quite a team there. If we had had a little more depth in our pitching, I think we could have been in on a World Series. It would have been really nice.
After Ted's playing career, later he came back to the Reds as a coach and as a hitting instructor. And how satisfying was that for him? Because I've heard some of these players from the Big Red Machine era give him a whole lot of credit for helping them as ball players and hitters.
Actually, he was going to go down and see if he could interview for the manager's job. But as he was driving down, he had the radio on, and they had said that they had signed Sparky Anderson. So he didn't turn around and go back, but he did go down and see what was going on. Yes, big satisfaction. He was a good teacher, I think, related to the players because of what he had attained in his career. I think that's a big factor.
I heard Marty Brenneman talking on the radio, and he was standing at the batting cage with Ted one day. And some hitter who was really struggling. And Marty says, are you going to go talk to him? And he says, no. When he comes to me, then I'll talk to him. Because if I go to him, he's not going to listen to me. But if he comes to me, then he really wants to be helped.
Right.
And that was kind of the philosophy.
Yeah, he didn't try to change the players. That's kind of hard to do. But little things you can pick up on. Or if they, again, fell into a slump, then he could see what they were doing. He always said, see the ball, hit the ball. That's how simple he tried to make it. Didn't always work out that way either.
In your case, with Gus Bell and Buddy and Buddy's sons, that's got to make you enormously proud to have, I mean, it's so rare, three generations of Major League Baseball players from one family. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah, it is. David is going to be third base coach for the Cubs. It makes you feel really good and things like that. But even better than that, they are super good kids. So all that other stuff is really good to go along with it, but they really are good kids. Buddy's got a great family.
Nice.
He's taught them well.
Yes, he has.
And you didn't have anything to do with that, right? She's a good grandmother.
All things considered, though, you wouldn't trade this experience for anything?
Oh, my goodness, no. We've met presidents. We've traveled. Had a nice home. I still have a nice place. Joyce doesn't live very far from me. No, I would never have dreamed that it would go to that degree.
You can't ask for more than that.
No, definitely not.
Oh, but the best thing is the friends you have.
Keep the friends.
And the fun memories of it and things like that. Because really, a lot of our friends have passed away, but we've known each other.
You should have been on a road trip with us.
Yeah, since... 1953,
four ladies that were not maybe quite, well, I'm the oldest, but the senior citizens, and we sat on the bed and giggled like high school girls.
But that,
we've known each other since the 50s.
But you can still sit around and talk about the fun times. And I don't think anybody sits around and talks about the bad times. I honestly don't remember.
Well, we didn't have bad times.
No, I mean, it was just... It was fun. It was really...
You know, we lived in an era, though, unfortunately, that doesn't exist anymore. I can relate that my sister never locked her doors. A lot of people never did that. Unfortunately, you're not safe anyplace anymore, and that's a sad story.
Mm-hmm.
But we lived in an era that was... People were polite. They looked out for each other. And if they do, the papers do not write it and play it up. It's always the bad stuff that makes the front pages. I'm not saying that drugs were not around, but certainly not to the depth. And the steroids that these guys were taking to hit the 70 home runs or whatever they were doing, I don't consider that a record, not when you enhance your strength.
Well, I mean, it was a great era of baseball.
True.
And it's the era that I, you know,
and there's nothing like Old Crosley Field, though.
Exactly.
You go in the big ballparks, and it's just not the same. Remember the lady, I don't remember what her name was, at the refreshment stand with the dark hair and the red lipstick, and she always had the red flower behind her ear here. You knew everybody down there. You knew all the ushers. I mean, it felt like home. You go into the big stadiums now. They're wonderful. They're beautiful. But you don't have that close feeling.
Oh, my goodness, no.
Can you imagine putting temporary folding chairs in the outfield on opening day? On the terrace,
like they used to
out there. Nobody can comprehend that they used to do that.
I can remember every smell of that place. I had so many good times there when I was a little kid. But
it was a great time.
Yeah.
We still have people that come up and remember Ladies' Day. That was their thing to do. If you see pictures, you see the guys in hats. Well, that was back in the 20s, though. But, I mean, I'm not that old. Well, almost.
Well, everybody got dressed up on me.
Right.
I mean,
you had hats
and gloves.
Yes.
And men had their suits and their ties on at opening day.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I mean, it was a big occasion. It's still a big occasion, but not a dress-up occasion like it used to be, you know.
Dress down more than dress up.
Yeah, those were fun.
Definitely had to have new dress, right?
Oh, absolutely, and a hat.
And that's another thing. We wore dresses to the ball games.
Well, that was another thing, though, that you had to dress up.
Yes.
If you didn't dress up to go to a game, because I remember, I would say who the person was called into the office because she was not dressed up, and that was a reflection on the ball club. So you had to be dressed up in high heel shoes and your dress.
But they can't do that anymore nowadays.
And the players, when they were traveling, they had some pretty strict rules about how they had to appear. And
exactly.
Yeah.
Shirts, ties.
Now they're all carrying their little magic boxes.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, Gus would never have carried a purse.
I don't think so.
He was not a purse person.
No, I don't think so.
You want to sing Take Me Out to the Ball Game?
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out to the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks. I don't care if I ever get back. I root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. It's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out at the old ball game.
Joe McMillan is the wife of the late Roy McMillan, who was a great Cincinnati Reds shortstop of the 1950s, played for the Reds from 1951 through 1960, won 3 gold gloves, and was one of the greats of that era. Tell me a little bit about how you and Roy met, because I know that you got married while he was in the major leagues.
We were in school together. He was 2 grades ahead of me, but that's how we knew each other. And then we, of course, went together off and on for 4 years and finally decided to get married, and that was in 1952.
So you had been sort of high school sweethearts?
Well, not particularly in high school, no. I was still in school when I think I first noticed him really a lot. Of course, he played sport, and then I didn't think anything about going or dating him until later. After I was in college, we kind of made a connection. And he was playing with Tyler then in that league. So that's the first introduction I had to baseball.
In 1951, obviously, he came up to the major leagues with the Cincinnati Reds. As you say, you got married the next year. I grew up going to Crosley Field as a fan, as a little kid. And to me, it was kind of a magical place. Can you talk a little bit about Crosley Field from a baseball wife's perspective? What do you remember about it?
I was just awed by it. It was kind of a large facility considering what we had down here in our area of Texas. Everybody was so nice to me as well as all the wives. We just felt privileged and enjoyed every bit of it when we would go. I don't recall when they quit having doubleheader ball games, but that was a lengthy Sunday most of the time.
Yes, that's a long day at the ballpark. Did the wives mostly sit together at the ballpark?
Yes, we all sat together behind home plate, so we would be protected. And that was a good thing because we all liked to talk, you know, each other, and we might not have watched the ball so much. But anyway, it was nice. We had a good group of people on all the teams. We had been married 8 years when he was traded. So my first year up there was 53. We married in the fall of 52, and we moved right to Cincinnati then, but I had not been in spring training until 53.
I'm looking at a 1955 Cincinnati Reds yearbook that I've kept over the years, and it has the picture of Roy and yourself and little baby David.
Yes, and David was born in 54.
And Roy's wearing his bow tie, and it looks like it's at your home in Cincinnati or possibly in Texas. Tell me about the interaction that you had with the fans in those days.
Well, I don't know that I really had a lot of interaction with them except for neighbors that we lived nearby in those years. There was a bowling team. We had the Reds ladies bowling team.
Yeah.
And, of course, that gave us a different perspective going to the bowling alley as a group. We had a lot of fun doing that.
Who were some of the wives who were on the bowling team?
Doris Bell and Doc Anderson's wife. Doc was a trainer. Becky Temple, two of your grandmas, Marianne Klipstein, and Dorothy Jablonski.
Yeah, that's some
myself.
The wives so of some of the big stars on the team.
That was in 1956. I know we did that 1 year, and then we, of course, lived in Cincinnati year-round there for about 2 years, 3 years. We did have some acquaintances outside of baseball.
What's interesting, if you look at the 1955 yearbook, and this was the case in all the yearbooks in those days, when they would profile the players, they would list their home addresses and where they lived. And in your case, it was up on Montgomery Road at one point. Was that ever a problem?
No, not that I recall. Of course, we lived several different places in Cincinnati, but we ended up living there on Montgomery Road, and that was when my oldest son was born. And we stayed there a couple of years, I guess, and then decided to come back to Bonham, our hometown, and we bought a small house here. So we would have a home base. And of course, my parents and Roy's mother were still here, so that was nice. I think we stayed up there another winter time all year, a couple other times later in the 50s.
Bonham, Texas is the home of two great Red Stars, Roy McMillan and Joe Morgan was born there.
That's correct. Yeah, Joe was born here. In fact, they had a day for him one time here, and quite a few years ago. They also had one for Roy, so Bonham's been good to the ballplayers.
Tell me about Roy. Were there particular teammates that he was particularly close to, good friends with? Who did he?
Well, Joe Adcock was the best man in our wedding, and he had become friends with Joe in the first year he played with Cincinnati. He was brought up to Cincinnati from Tulsa. And, of course, then we've had other friends like the Klazuskis and the Bells and the Wehmeyers. I still talk to Grady and Doris Hatton occasionally. They're just a number of that group that was there first 2 or 3 years that we were friends with, and I think living there year-round, we all became more bonded because we all had the same thing in common, being in the baseball world. I've kept up with a number of people.
You know, I know for baseball-wise, I mean, even today, it's difficult sometimes because your husband is gone for a large part of the year, and if you're raising children, how much of a challenge was that for you?
I was always very independent, and I didn't rely on a lot of people to entertain me, but some of the wives, we'd get together at somebody's house. I recall taking the portable crib several times to Joyce Bell's house because it was easier for me to take one child than for her to move her 3 or 4 children at the time. And we would all get together and eat and talk and have a good time and pass an evening away like that. And so most of the girls were self-sufficient.
After a game, if Roy came home to Montgomery Road or wherever you were living at the time, did he talk about the game or did he leave it at the ballpark?
He left it at the ballpark. I knew not to say too much, especially if he'd had a bad day fielding or something, but he didn't discuss it over and over.
I know a lot of the players of that era, obviously, they didn't make the kind of money that baseball players make today in the major leagues, and many of them worked off-season jobs or had other income. Did Roy do that?
We lived in Cincinnati. He worked for the ball club a couple of years, and Burger Brewery one winter, and maybe a couple other things that I've forgotten. And then we had some pizza restaurants in Hamilton at one time, and he went there or stayed up there a lot in the wintertime. Then in home here, there it was a small town. You didn't have a great deal to do, so he bought some property and put in a fish farm. Then later years, after he retired, he had another piece of property that he and my son did a grape vineyard. They did that until he died, and I didn't keep it.
But it sounds like he stayed pretty active over the off season.
Oh, yeah. He was doing something most of the time.
Were you going to spring training, spending the time down there?
Oh, I went to spring training until the oldest boy got in the second or third grade. Then it was just too hard to do. And then I think I had Patsy, my daughter. I had two sons and a daughter, and she was born in 64. And so I think I had quit going down there and staying the whole spring training. I usually made a trip down there myself, but didn't take the children.
For much of his time with the Reds, obviously Bertie Tebbets was his manager. What do you remember about Bertie?
I just remember I liked him very much, and his wife also, and they were just good people.
Bertie always had a lot of good things to say about Roy. He talked about his defensive skills and how he was the best he had seen in 20 years, and always seemed to be a big supporter of Roy.
He had a lot of support from most of the managers that he had, and all the time with Cincinnati, he did quite well as far as reports from those people.
Tell me a little bit about what do you think he was proudest of in his career?
The All-Star Games, I think, and the Gold Gloves were the highlights when he was with Cincinnati. And so he was proud of the fact that he had gone to two All-Star Games and then had the three Gold Gloves. I still have those and the All-Star Game awards that they gave.
You have quite a collection of his memorabilia?
Yes, I've kept a lot of things. Sure have. And then it gets quite a bit of a problem because I don't know what to do with them. But I don't want to do away with them. The kids, that's their responsibility one of these days.
Let's go!
Priscilla Stowe is the wife of senior equipment manager Bernie Stowe, who joined the Reds in 1947 as a clubhouse boy. Bernie's sons, Rick and Mark Stowe, have continued the family tradition. Rick is the Reds equipment manager, and Mark is the visiting clubhouse manager. Priscilla, what got you interested in baseball?
In those days, when you listened to the radio, you sat in front of the radio. My father was interested in I'd always see him during the game sitting in front of the radio, and sometimes I'd join him. My mother worked at a Crosley facility, and she got tickets, and my father took me and my brother. And then when I was a sophomore in high school,
I met a couple of girls from, I lived on Columbia Parkway, and they lived down in Sedamsville, and they were into baseball, and she knew somebody that had started the Frank Smith fan club. Oh, my ears perked up because I was so interested in baseball. So that's how I got affiliated with a bunch of people that were of the same interest that I did. And we had girls from all over the city in northern Kentucky. It's amazing how we all got together. It was just word of mouth, I think, and meeting at the ballpark, mostly on Ladies' Day, because it was only 25 cents to go to the ball game on Ladies' Day if you sat in the far left field or far right field. And then as we got older and had a little bit of money, we'd buy tickets in the grandstand and sit down in left field by the bullpen. And we always knew if we went to the game, they'd always be somebody down there, another couple girls that came, and we'd have a little social hour there. That was always down in left field there. And we'd have meetings in the winter because there was no ball games, and we'd write up little newsletters. One of our big activities, the biggest, I guess, that we did in the summer that included the players, we always had a picnic at Burnett Woods, and all of the fan clubs would participate. Art Fowler, Corky Valentine, Ted Kluszewski, Ed Bailey, and all of the players and their families would be invited. As far as other activities, we'd get together with each other. Mind you, we were only high school girls, and we didn't have cars. We did everything. We had to go on the bus everywhere we went. None of us drove. It wasn't like you got a car when you were 16, because it just, none of us had that available. That was mostly what we did, our activities. Like I said, our big activity was the picnic and our meetings. It was a social thing for us, and then going to the games and talking about the players. Some of the girls would get in touch with the families during the winter. I didn't. We had a president. I wasn't an officer, so she'd sometimes through Christmas cards or something like that, get in touch with the families. That's about all we did. It lasted, well, about 4 years, 15 to 19 was the age bracket that we were in, that we were interested in fan clubs, as we called them.
Priscilla, you and Bernie have enjoyed a long marriage. How did you two first meet?
He was a bat boy, so I always say we met at Crosley Field, but we really didn't. He had another friend that worked in the umpire's room, so he didn't have anything to do when the game started, so he came down and sat with us down in left field. So we always, because we didn't drive, we took buses. We went down to downtown, and on Sunday, they were Sunday afternoon games, and we'd go to, it's called Minute Chef. It was in the Gibson Hotel. We always stopped and got a sandwich or something like that, and they knew we always went there, and him and Hoagie, as we called him, his name was Bill Herbst, they came down and met us, and Bernie had a car in them days, so he offered to take us home. That's how we met.
Talk about your friendship with Eleanor Kluszewski.
I do more now than I did back then. She socialized more with the other players' wives, and I did a little bit when she was a coach's wife. We went on functions where all the coaches' wives and the players' wives, we did some of that. But now I socialize with her. We go to lunch. We meet up with Donzetta Nuxall and Joyce Bell. We just reminisce about the olden days and the difference between the olden days and now, and have a nice lunch.
Betty Hoyt is the widow of longtime Reds broadcaster and Hall of Fame Yankees pitcher Wade Hoyt. Betty, did you ever listen to Wade's broadcasts?
Oh, yes. I listened to him when he was broadcasting at Crosley Field, but not in the beginning, because Roger Baker was the announcer that I sort of grew up with. And I stuck with him, even though Wade Hoyt came here, because I didn't know who Wade Hoyt was. And I must admit that I did not listen to him as soon as he came here. I think he came in the mid-40s, because there were other announcers here at the same time. At that time, the Reds were on three different stations, the Reds broadcasts. Then when Roger Baker left, I went over to Wade. And of course, I saw immediately that this man was far better than Roger Baker. Oh, I always listened to the ball games. Oh, I never missed a Reds game. Oh, I was a big baseball fan. And the 39-40 Reds are still my favorite ball club of all times. I worked in an advertising agency, the Ralph Jones Agency. They knew I was a real ball fan in there, and I was also thinking about leaving. I had to work every night. So one of the men said to me, you know, the fact that you're leaving, I think I know a place they're looking for somebody, and they have to know a lot about baseball, and you do. And he said, it's the National League office, which is in this building, which was the crew tar. He said, if you're interested, I can set up an appointment for you, which he did. I went in and met Dave Grody, who was the publicity director of the league at the time. And he said, well, now you have to know a lot about baseball. And I said, well, I think I know pretty much about it. He said, well, I'll find out. So he's asking me questions, not just about the Reds, but about all the clubs in the National League, the American League, history going way, way back. He said, well, you do know a lot about baseball. I would hire you on the spot, but I have another appointment with another girl who actually worked in baseball. And I thought, oh, there goes the job, because I didn't work in baseball. About a week passed, and I didn't hear anything, and I thought, well, that little dream got nowhere. It was on my birthday, and I got a phone call. Hi, this is Dave Grody. I'm wondering if you could come in to see us this afternoon. And I said, sure. And they were taking me out for lunch. I didn't enjoy that lunch any more than here's this job out there that I want. There's a possibility now I'm going to get it because they want to see me again. So I went in and he said, the job is yours if you can answer one question. And I thought, this is going to be probably a trick question. What is the standing of the National League clubs as of this morning? So I went, I said, I know the American League too. And he said, well, that's not necessary, but let's hear it. And he said, the job is yours.
Tell us about the time you first met Wade.
I can't remember when Babe Ruth died, but it was a couple of years later, which would have been in the 50s. And I was in New York with my mother, and we were walking on Fifth Avenue one day. And this man was coming toward us. It was after the ball season was over. And I said, this is Wade Hoyt. So as he approached, I said, Mr. Hoyt? And he said, yes. We're some of your Cincinnati fans. He said, what's your name? Betty Deary. And he said, you're Betty Deary. Oh, my gosh. And he shook my hand because we were writing back and forth fan letters. He loved to write letters. He loved his fans. If you would write a fan letter, he would answer you, and then he would have something in there that you had to answer back. And this wasn't just with a few people. This was all over the country. He was getting fan mail. When I saw him in New York, I wasn't working in baseball. I was working for an ad agency. But then a couple of years later, I got a job working in a National League office, which was in Cincinnati in the crew tar. I was just there a few days, and I ran into him down in the lobby of the building. And I said, oh, Mr. Hoyt. And he said, yeah. And I said, Betty Deary. And he said, oh, Betty, how are you? I'm working in the National League now. And he said, for Giles? And I said, well, he's the big boss, but I'm working for Dave Grody and Fred Flagg. And he said, are you going up there now? And I said, yeah. And he said, I'll go with you. So he came in, and when Wade would walk in, it was like a tornado hit. I mean, he was... hello, everybody, you know. And he came in, and it was a small office. But for some reason, everybody was out in the little main office. And he said, you didn't tell me you were going to hire Betty. Why, she's been one of my oldest and dearest friends. And they said, what? And he said, we go back a long time. She's been a real good friend, which wasn't so. That was the way he was. When he left, they said, well, why didn't you say you were a friend of Wade Hoyt's? Well, I wanted to get the job on my own merits, not that. That was the kind of person he was.
Where did you get married?
We got married in Chicago. We were married in the apartment of his niece who lived in Chicago. Very simple wedding. Would you like to hear about our wedding reception? Well, as I said, we were married in Chicago. We had a very small wedding in Chicago. And then when we came back, first we went to Florida for our honeymoon, and that was for Red's spring training. And we stayed down there for a week. Then we came back, and then that Sunday, we were going to have a big reception in our apartment. We lived in Highland Towers in Mount Adams. And it was a big apartment, but not that big. So we're putting down all of the people. He had a list, and I had a list, and it came out to about 300 people. And I said, wait, we can't invite all these people. Where can we put them? And he said, it was from 2 to 6, and they'll be coming and going all day. I said, well, okay. So we invited all of the people, and we invited the regulars, the people who he had wrote to for many years. There were 30 different people that we invited that were regulars who he had never seen ever. So he said, yeah, this will be fun to invite them. And he said, I don't think any of them will come, but let's just invite them. Well, we sent out 300 invitations. All the people came, and they came early. They stayed late. I'll tell you, it was such fun because I handled all his fan mail. So these regulars were people that I felt like I knew too. And nobody looked the way I thought they would look. And they were such fun, and they all were bearing gifts. It was so crowded that you couldn't move. This one good friend of mine, she and her husband came, and they became impaled against a door. They never got past that door. They said, we couldn't move. It was in March, and it was one of those real, like a summer day. We lived on a 26th floor, and we had a little balcony. A lot of these people were all out there, and they were sitting on those railings, 26th floor. You know, anybody could have fallen off of those things. I was worried sick that the thing was going to collapse with all of these people out there. There was like maybe 50 people out there. And, well, nothing like that happened. We had a caterer. Everybody talked about how wonderful the food was, and I didn't have a bite. Anyway, it was supposed to end at 6 o'clock, and at 8 o'clock, they were all there yet. Nobody left.
What kind of person was Wade?
Oh, he was warm and wonderful. He loved to talk, and he was a very sweet man. He loved his fans. Whenever we would go out for dinner or lunch, inevitably someone would come over with a little piece of paper and say, Mr. Hoyt, could I have your autograph? And he'd say, sit down. And he'd say, oh, let's forget this little piece of paper. Give me your name and address, and I'll send you something better than that. Well, he would always send them an autographed picture. And he would sit there and talk with the person. This is lunch or dinner. Food is getting cold. And the person would leave, and he would say, wasn't that nice of him to stop by? He said it every time. Never did he ever say, can't I ever sit down and eat that somebody doesn't interrupt? Never. And he used to say, these are the people that put the food on my table.
Betty, did you have much interaction with Wade's fans?
Every week, I would get a box from the club, the Reds, from the brewery, Burger Brewer, that was his sponsor. He would have some. And let's see, there was another. I would get 4 boxes or bags of mail. And you just can't believe how much mail was in there. I could answer them all. Because I knew exactly his phraseology. I could handle that. I was someplace a few years ago, and there was a girl there. Oh, she said, I have a letter, and she showed me the letter. This is a letter that I got from Wade, and I recognized it immediately. It was my letter. But of course, he signed them, and he put a personal message on every letter. I would give up my whole Saturday and Sunday and do nothing but answer fan mail.
The fellow said to me, last year it was, he said, I wonder what they will say 300 years from now. I said, what do you mean? He said, how will they describe baseball then? they'll be talking about the game that used to be. I said, what do you mean the game that used to be? Well, he says it wasn't in existence 300 years ago, and there's no reason to believe that it will be in existence 300 years from now. Well, that's a little far-fetched, and that's perverse thinking in a way, but it could be. Maybe some of these games like baseball and football will be replaced by others, but this has been a grand game, and it's served a lot of purposes, a lot of people, a lot of youth, and a lot of Ulsters. And it's a game to be thought of in, they say, national pastime, and occasionally people in other sports question whether this is the national pastime. And with no effort to deprecate any other sport in the world, because they're all fine sports, and I'm really a sports lover of all types. Love football, basketball, hockey. And it may be that a fellow gets a little too old to take them all in, but on the other hand, they're all great. But this has been a game that has had seen very little change in some respects, and through the years has done a lot for a lot of people, both on the field and spectators.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Reds Baseball Wise, produced by Lee Hay with technical support from Kevin Lewinsky. I'm Howard Wilkinson. Thanks for listening.